You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with your host, Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister Dee Combs. Sankofa Council Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Reach out to them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived, so just go to www.timeforanawakening, access the search portal, type in the name of the program you desire to review.
We're poor, Ashe. We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We poor to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Okay.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pits pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, oh my God, oh Madre de Dios, who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions, the children of those who could not be killed. We pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X,
John Henry Clark, John Jackson, Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with your host, Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Clare, and Sister D.D. Connors. Sankofa Council Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Reach out to them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived, so just go to www.timeforanawakening, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
Welcome. We are delighted to have you today with us, the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee. This is Dr. Janine James, your host, and also Brother Charles Robinson will be here with us. Sister Dee Dee will not be with us today, but we're so happy to have our Brother Charles with us, and we are so delighted to be here with a program that I have been so looking forward to, and I'm so proud of all of the guests who are here with us today. We will be talking about today, with the help of our guests, about future Black physicians, calling all future Black physicians. The health care of Black Americans have been tied to the number of Black physicians providing healthcare services. Despite efforts to increase the number of Black physicians over the last 50 years, we are seeing a decline in the number of Black physicians. The Cream City Medical Society of Milwaukee has continued its efforts to increase the number of Blacks entering medicine by writing for grants, and other efforts in the community to let our community know what our needs are. Our guest today will be Delisha Randall Izzard, MD. Dr. Randall Izzard is a family medicine physician and has played a big role by the writing for grant Pipeline to Practice program, and her efforts will be joined by two members from the Medical College of Wisconsin, Mr. Anton Johnson III and Ms. Adrienne German. And we're also delighted to have Dr. Talanda Lipsy Brown, who is a science and health educator, and who was born and raised here in Milwaukee, attended Vincent High School, where she graduated as valedictorian and went on to attend Marquette University. And so we are so happy to have her here to get her take on this process of preparing people for medicine. Ms. German and Mr. Johnson from the Medical College are involved with the admissions and recruiting, as well as the equity activities of the Medical College of Wisconsin. So it's important that we have these guests here who will discuss some of the efforts that are being made and that are needed from our community and other partners to improve the health care for Black Americans. But before we go on to our guests, we're so happy to have again our co-host, Brother Charles Robinson, and he's going to be so kind to help us with our ancestral profile today. Brother Robinson.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. James, for inviting me to participate in this conversation. And I'm so delighted to share some information about someone who I think all of us hold in high regard, Dr. Percy Julian Sr. I knew his son, Percy Julian Jr., who actually represented us when we were in college. We had some problems in the 70s. Actually, it was in 69. And we needed a lawyer, a civil rights lawyer, and Percy Julian's son was our representative. But Percy Julian Sr., I didn't know at the time, was a famous African-American chemist. And he was a pioneer in the chemical synthesis of medical drugs such as cortisone, steroids, and birth controls. He was a pioneering chemist who was not allowed to attend high school, believe it or not, but went on to earn his PhD. His research at academic and corporate institutions led to the chemical synthesis of drugs to treat glaucoma, arthritis, and although his race presented challenges at every turn, he is regarded as one of the most influential chemists in American history. Percy LaVon Julian was born April 11, 1899 in Montgomery, Alabama, the grandson of former slaves. He attended school through the eighth grade, but there were no high schools open to Black students at that time. He applied to DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana, where he had to take high school level classes in the evening to get him up to the academic level of his peers. In spite of this challenging beginning, he graduated first in his class with Phi Beta Kappa honors. After college, Julian accepted a position as a chemistry instructor at Fisk University. He left in 1923 when he received a scholarship to attend Harvard University to finish his master's degree, though the university would not allow him to pursue his doctorate. He traveled for several years teaching at Black colleges before obtaining his PhD at the University of Vienna in Austria in 1931. With his doctorate in hand, he returned to DePaul to continue his research. In 1935, he earned international acclaim by synthesizing physostigmine. I know I mispronounced it. But anyway, it's from the Calabar bean to create a drug treatment for glaucoma. But in spite of his success, the university refused to make him a full professor because of his race. Desiring to leave academia, Julian applied for jobs at prominent chemical companies, but was repeatedly rejected when hiring managers discovered that he was Black. Ultimately, he obtained a position at Glidden Company as the lab director. There he invented aerofoam, a product that uses soy protein to put out oil and gas fires, and was widely used in World War II, as well as other soybean-based inventions. Julian continued his biomedical work as well, and discovered how to extract sterols from soybean oil and synthesize the hormones progesterone and testosterone. He was also lauded for his synthesis of cortisone, which became used in the treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. Julian left Glidden in 1953 and established his own laboratory, Julian Laboratories, in 1954. He sold the company in 1961, becoming one of the first black millionaires, before founding Julian Research Institute, a nonprofit organization that he ran for the rest of his life. He died of liver cancer on April 19, 1975. In 1973, Julian became the first black chemist elected to the National Academy of the Sciences. In 1990, he was elected to the National Inventors Hall of Fame. And in 1999, his synthesis of physostigmine was recognized by the American Chemical Society as one of the top 25 achievements in the history of American chemistry. He met his wife, Anna Roselle, while employed at Howard University, and the two of them were accused of having an affair while she was married to one of his colleagues. A scandal ensued and Julian was fired, but he and Anna married in 1935 and had two children. In 1950, Julian and his family moved to Oak Park, Illinois, after they purchased their home. But before they moved in, the house was firebombed on Thanksgiving Day. It was attacked again in June of 1951. Julian's life was the subject of a documentary made by PBS Nova series entitled Forgotten Genius. Wow. That's it. That's the, you know, that's what we have to go through.
Well, thank you.
The history of black genius in America.
That information is so good to hear, because you've added a little more of the history that I wasn't aware of. I'm from Chicago, and my goddaughter attended DePaul University, and this is where I knew about him being in a place where he couldn't live on campus. They weren't such a supportive institution for him to attend. And then years later, my goddaughter attended there and is now a physician, but they weren't particularly supportive even as late as the last few years. So I think we've got a lot of work to do, and which I think is why it's so important to recognize the work that Dr. Randall Lizard has done and her reaching out to some others so that we can do better. I guess that's all we can ask for, is that people try to do better. And so I'm so glad that you presented this information to us.
Well, you know, it was so amazing. When I was in college, I played football, and I had a quadricep injury in practice, and they took me to Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, and shot me up with cortisone. I had no idea that a black man had invented cortisone. And then the following year, being represented by that black man's son, Percy Julian Jr., who ultimately we became colleagues after I finished law school, and we actually were on the same mediation boards for the EEOC and the U.S. Postal Service. But that's small world.
Yes, it is. Well, we're so happy to have that presentation, Brother Charles, and gives me a great pleasure to introduce a colleague, a member of the Cream City Medical Society in Milwaukee, and a family medicine physician, Dr. Randall Lizard. Thank you for being with us today. Hmm. Let's see if we have her unmuted. Dr. Randall Lizard, you with us?
Oh, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I was saying thank you for having me here. And I'm really excited about this, about being able to discuss my passion, which is medicine, but really about how to get that next generation into the medical field, and not only in the medical field, but thrive, especially after hearing about, you know, Dr. Julian. I didn't know all the details about him and what he went through. And we still are going through a lot of things that we really should not still be going through. And I want to tell you a little bit of the data and why I started with my husband this program for American descendants of slavery. And it's specifically for American descendants of slavery because of some data that we have found when we were doing research on Black physicians. So I am originally from Missouri, and I've been here in Wisconsin for 20 years, so I consider myself a Wisconsinite for the most part right now. And have been at MCW and was a graduate from there, and took time off to raise my family. My husband's also a physician. And during that time, though, we mentor and tutor and mentor other physicians or students who are want to become physicians. And during that time when we were doing that, we were looking at not only are there not any Black or a limited number of Black physicians, the Black physicians did not have the lineage to American slavery. And so we were wondering if there was something that was being masked. And with our data, we did find that there is a masking of, well, the suppression of Black ABOS physicians. So so we wrote a grant with Crim City Medical Society, which is the Black physicians, Black podiatrists, and Black dentists and pharmacists who are actually involved in this program and are mentors for this program as well. It is through Advocate Aurora, their Better Together Fund. And I just started it actually in December. We started doing the research in 2018, 2019, so a lot of my data is from that. I have some of the more data from 2020 if it is needed, if you guys want it. So when we started doing our data, we found that, well, like we know, about anywhere between 6 to 8% of the physicians with the MD degree are Black. So that's the general population of Black. In 2002, the AAMC allowed the category of Black to be disaggregated. So then you have African, African American, Afro-Caribbean, other, and more than one. So it's difficult to look at the data going back and forth. So I'm doing the best that I can to try to figure out exactly what does African American mean nowadays? Does it mean that you have lineage to slavery or not? And that's what I'm going to assume when I give my data. So, unfortunately, what we did find, and the real key point, I guess, would be takeaway, is that in 1978, there were 1,410 Black men who applied to medicine, and 540 matriculated. And it's almost the same in 2020. It was 1,457 Black men who applied to medical school, and about 665 that matriculated. So it's pretty flat for Black men, and even in some ways have went backwards, because when you say Black in the United States, that can include all of diaspora. So when we go and take that apart and tease apart the categories, we found that approximately about 45% of the students, admitted matriculating students, have a lineage, we think, to American descendants of slavery. So in reality, because in 1978, only about 3% of the population had lineage outside of the United States. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, there was something in the background. So so unfortunately, in 2020, that means that in actuality, there are less Black ADOS males in medical school than there were in 1978.
You know what? That's exactly what I've discovered for law school, and I blame that on what you called how they disaggregated. You know, how they category students, because we used to have a Black American Law School Association called BALSA, and I'm sure the medical college had something similar, but they took out Black, and then they began to use language like diversity and inclusion, and so now you can put anybody who's non-European in that category.
Yeah,
it's misleading. When I graduated from law school, we had at least 20 to 25 graduates in 76. And when I looked last night, I was just curious. I looked, and last year at University of Wisconsin, they only had 5 graduates.
Yes.
5 graduates from law school. So I would suspect there's something similar like that in the medical college.
I believe so, and I believe that in Madison as well. However, we'll have to have that discussion about whether or not that data can be disaggregated, because you need to know where you are before we can move anywhere, right? So we need to kind of have that data, and it's hard to get that data teased out at some of the institutions.
Thank you, Dr. Randall Lizard. This is most enlightening. And I would like to, and I will come back to you. I would like to address Dr. Talanda Lipsey Brown. It is a great pleasure to do so, especially since she is from Milwaukee and has been through this journey. And I'd like for her to, Dr. Lipsey Brown, if you would like to share with us what your journey has been in healthcare, and I think it will be very helpful for our listeners to hear from your perspective about the planned project, or this new project, and what thoughts you'd like to share with our other guests.
Sure. Thank you so much, Dr. James and Brother Robinson, and thank you so much for allowing me to be here to discuss my experiences. As you've mentioned, I received my primary and secondary education from the Milwaukee Public School System, and I excelled within the school system, even becoming the first African-American valedictorian in the history of my high school. Now, today, that might not mean, well, today schools are segregated once again, but back when I graduated in 1999, there was less segregation in the school system, so it was a little more, we had a bit more diversity there, but it wasn't until after I entered college that I learned that I was not given all of the tools that I needed to ensure my academic success. And so I found the pursuit of my bachelor's degree to be quite challenging at times. And, you know, as you mentioned, I went to Marquette University. I majored in biology. I graduated high school with a 4.0 grade point average. When I left Marquette University, my grade point average was a 2.9, and so far from a 4.0, and I did not have the grades necessary to successfully enter medical school or to be accepted into medical school. And so I went on a whole soul-seeking journey, and this whole revelation inspired me to pursue a career in education. So I ended up teaching 3 years in the Milwaukee Public School System, and I chose to teach at the very same high school that I attended in an effort to lead by example through sharing my story and my experiences with other teachers. so that we can help prepare students so that they too, that they would not be unprepared for academic success upon entering college. And it was during when I taught high school that I found out that students were being even less prepared than when I was in school. And so that prompted me to look at this. This has to be a deeper issue. And so I pursued my master's and then my PhD in urban education. And through studying the data, I was unable to uncover the systems of inequities which existed and continue to exist, which serve as gatekeeping mechanisms of preventing our students from succeeding and going into these professional fields such as medicine.
Wow. I'm so impressed, and I would like to acknowledge you for going back to the school that you graduated from because of your commitment to make a difference and to transform education. And
thank you.
I had that same experience. I went back to the junior high school that I graduated from, and there was so much systemic and structural racism that I didn't notice when I was a student there. But we had a building where 900 was the capacity. We had 1,600 students in that building at Robert Fulton Junior High School. I mean, that's just one example.
Absolutely. And our students are being told that it's their fault. You know, when they get into these higher education settings and they, you know, go into, they're looking to pursue careers in certain fields. And, you know, when they don't necessarily make the cut, they're told it's their fault instead of addressing the inequities which allow such systems to exist and to persist.
Well, this is certainly enlightening for us. And I think it is important for people to at least eventually recognize that the lack of success may not be a result of lack of interest. But I firmly believe that throughout the educational system, there is little regard for our contributions and our higher education. So there is not the detailed preparation that is required of a physician. And this is, of course, something that the student is not going to be aware of what it is that he needs. It really is in the role, Dr. Lipsy Brown, that you presently are in, it is those instructors, those teachers that really have that charge to ensure that those who aspire to this these types of careers have the skills that are necessary for this to happen. And I just am so fortunate to have had a dedicated group of teachers, but I was in a segregated school system. I had very highly trained teachers who really prepared me quite well for being successful not only in college, but in medical school. But that was in a segregated system. And each of these teachers, I would suspect many of them hope to be physicians themselves. And because of so many of the issues that we're talking about and we'll talk about, were not able to do so. But they did what was necessary so that I had the preparation, as well as quite a number of my classmates who went on to medicine from the same high school. So I appreciate what you're sharing with us, and I know you have more for us, Dr. Lipsy Brown, but I'd like to also please to bring to our attention Mr. Anton Johnson and also Miss Adrienne German, if she's joined us as well, from our hometown medical school, the Medical College of Wisconsin. And I'd like to open up to allow you to share with us what role that you see the medical college has with the pipeline to practice, and what roles are going to be necessary to take a very active effort to prepare young people for what is desperately needed, them in the workforce as not only health professionals, but specifically as physicians. Mr. Johnson, if you would please feel free to share with us your thoughts.
Absolutely. And again, first and foremost, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. So in my role, I'm the admissions recruiter / applicant advisor / a number of things for our MD program here at MCW. So I'm doing a lot of work, especially too, you know, with a focus on our underrepresented students, which is a euphemism in of itself, right? Underrepresented really means historically excluded. So yeah. With that, you know, we're really, you know, speaking to those kind of inequities that we've talked about in terms of preparing to apply, you know, for medical school. You know, there's so many students of different backgrounds, specifically Black American students, you know, their mom and dad aren't doctors to tell them how to go through this process and what and when to pay for what, you know, they might not have the same people or a brother or sister in medical school or, you know, going to a college with a very strong biology department or pre-medical club. So, you know, that's where we come into play, right? So being from, I don't know if Adrienne's on the call, but, you know, she oversees a lot of the pipeline programs that we have. And we have pipeline programs for people at the high school level and at the undergraduate level as well, you know, to guide them through this process. And she does a lot of work with them on in the Office of Student Inclusion and Diversity. And then me, from an admission standpoint, you know, a really big thing for me is not only making myself available to these student groups, but also to, you know, promoting the word, you know, not just to the Milwaukee community alone, but across the country. You know, there's so many talented, you know, young Black science majors across the country that aren't even considering Wisconsin, you know, because of what they heard, right? And being able to affect that change, you know, at MCW, you know, having a student body that reflects the diversity of the patient populations they're going to be serving, especially in a community like Milwaukee, is major. So there's really, you know, there's really a lot of work being done, but there's a lot of work to be done. And but we're trying our best to get the word out, you know, to students in the community, across the country, and really have that counseling edge and really take people in and let them know step by step, this is what you need to do, because we know there is inequities and they haven't had the same kind of support that the students that they're going to be competing with in the application process have.
Yes, I'm glad to hear there's more than one pipeline, because the pipeline that we hear about quite a bit is the pipeline from school to prison, especially right. In Wisconsin, where we incarcerate more Black men than any other state in the country.
Yes, sir.
But, you know, when you can't see your vision, if there's a lack of medical physicians in our community, then how do you motivate students to pursue a career in medicine? If that must be an uphill struggle.
It is. And, you know, I think a big thing, too, is, you know, culturally, especially speaking of black students, it's not like there's no interest in healthcare. Come on. The healthcare industry is dominated. The field is dominated by black people, especially black women. It really is at various different levels. Once we get to that MD level, you know, I'll be tabling at high schools or colleges or events all throughout the state and the city. And it never fails. I'll talk to a lot of black students, especially young black ladies. But, you know, not now the hurdle is like, okay, so do you guys have a nursing program? I'm like, no, we have an MD program. They're like, oh, I was looking for nursing. And I'm like, well, if you're interested in nursing, why not an MD?
Yes.
You know, there's some kind of intrinsic block here for a lot of our students that I'm working really hard on, to be totally honest with you. You know, having even just, you know, at the high school level, having like these seminars. I just talked to the 500 Stars group yesterday, actually. You know, have any of you ever considered being a doctor? No, I thought about being a nurse. Okay, why not a doctor? Let's talk about it.
Is there a fear or some kind of stigma attached to going on to that, to the next level in the medical profession? Is there fear? And what is that fear based on?
Finances. That's the big thing. The common pushbacks I get are, A, I'm not trying to be in school that long.
Yeah.
And B, you know, I don't want to owe that much money, right?
Yes.
And, you know, the first one, the time thing, there's no denying it. You know, yes, most of you aren't going to, you know, start really getting into the thick of it till you're about 29 years old. No denying that, right? But as far as the cost, okay, let's talk about it. You know, let's talk about early on how we can affect our grades. What can we apply for? What scholarships can we apply for? What resources? You know, there's so many black applicants every year that have no idea about the fee assistance program on the AMCAS application.
So we're not recognizing our resources, and we're not using those resources wisely. Yeah, I have a younger brother who was preparing himself to go to medical school, and he ended up changing his major to African American Studies. This is back in the 90s. But I got the impression that people around him kind of talked him out of medical school. You know, it's like, oh, wow, you're going to go to medical school? You know how long you're going to be in college? You know how expensive that? It was kind of like he didn't get the support from his surrounding environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't get people. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to chime in on that point of support. So just from not only my experience, but the experiences of many of my peers who are also interested in pursuing medicine, in our undergrad courses, we were one of often the only black person in our class. In a class of 200, there would be two or three black people in the class. Having those labs and doing those labs, and nobody wants to be your partner. Nobody invites you to their study groups and, you know, give you the information that they have access to. So I don't think that there is I'm not denying that perhaps there may be a lack of interest, but I do know that there is also great interest in people wanting to pursue medicine, but it is these gates. Keeping mechanisms such as not having lab partners, such as having instructors who are racist and consciously or unconsciously. And, you know, not having study groups, not having peer support, all of those things serve as reasons why we are not in the field.
And that's very true. No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
May I add some things? I agree totally with Dr. Lipsy Brown. I have that same experience myself, and students that we've mentored have had that experience where they're turned away because of they're discouraged, I should say, to continue
on the route. And it's easy for them to listen to that discouragement because they are one of the only there. And it's just it's easier to do something where they aren't one of the only. And so that's why we started this pipeline program as a community for the students to reach out to each other, to have each other, to support each other, to gather the resources in one place, and for them to be able to hopefully more easily access those resources. And so through this pipeline that we're doing, we're working with a number of people in the community. We work with MCW, we're working with Madison, we're working with Cream City. So they have mentors, they have advisors, they have people who will look over their applications who don't know them and give them feedback, but also they have people who know them intimately and give them feedback and also help them in their wellness as well. Because a lot of this is being able to put your head down, don't listen to the naysayers, and take care of yourself and have that support around you. And so that's what our pipeline is trying to do for the current students that we have right now. So I just want to say I completely agree with Dr. Lipsy Brown.
Dr. Izzard, you mentioned earlier back in 1978, you said that there were 1,410 applicants and only 540 actually matriculated. When you say applicants, were these people actually admitted,
they just applied? They just applied. So really the average has always been around 40%, somewhere between 40 and 42% or ish for acceptance rates to medical school for Black people.
While it's around
about 45% for white people, and then Hispanics can be as high as 47% accepted.
Now, those who were accepted, how many actually graduated? Do you have any stats on that?
No, I don't have that. We have matriculated data. Okay. So that just means that they actually went into the school. I don't know, Mr. Johnson, do you know that data?
Off the top of my head, I don't.
Okay.
But you know, it's definitely it bears watching. You know, we're still doing that. I mean, even at MCW, we kind of touched on it earlier. You know, kind of that overarching blanket of the word diversity, right?
Right.
Or underrepresented. You know, we're tracking the data, but the most recent, like in our leadership meeting that I saw, was we're counting our number of percentage of underrepresented students in the student population. You know, so I know that jumped from 12 to 14% the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And does that
that's just not does, speaking specifically to Black students?
Yeah, and does that include rural for you guys?
That does. So rural, LGBTQ, first generation college. That's that umbrella, like we were talking about. That it only does us so much good, right?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to really figure out where you are. You know,
I'm going to need to.
I mean, and I'm fairly new to my role
because we need to announce our sponsor, which is EDoc Advice. It is a website created to provide a place to go to get answers to your health or medical concerns. The questions are answered by health professionals and those who are knowledgeable about helping you make a decision about your personal health that makes sense to you. We do not replace your health professional or provide your care, but we can help you to become a better consumer so that you can get the best information to make a truly informed decision. We network with other health professionals throughout the country and bring that information to you. We are looking for sponsors, and if you have a book you've written or other information that you think would be important, consider being a sponsor for our program, Time for Awakening. Our email address is sankofacouncil mke@gmail.com. I'm really, really grateful to have this enlightening discussion with us. And I'm going to start with just a bit, which I hope we're going to be able to continue as we move on. I started in medicine in 1975 as a result of the help of several what I guess would be considered pipeline programs. So we do have a great deal of data that goes back to the 1970s about the successes and the benefit of nurturing those who are going into medicine. And I'm just so surprised that so little of that seems to be utilized to recognize the importance of doing so. But I would have expected, and I took the initiative myself to begin in academic medicine, because clearly we had very few faculty, very few teachers in medicine. And that situation, even though there are many more of us who not only are clinical physicians, but who have been in academic medicine teaching physicians, more need to be recruited to really make an impact on the preparation of people for medicine. And the reason I say that specifically, I can think about having received a great deal of support in high school, but when I went to college, the professors had me so disillusioned that I thought about dropping out of medicine, as many people had done prior to my coming to that particular university. And fortunately, my mother was a counselor in the public schools. And her work dealt with people selecting careers. So she gave me an aptitude test, and as we would expect, all of it led to the health sciences. And my mother went to the school and told my professor, "I didn't send my child here for you to discourage them. I sent her for you to teach them, teach her and teach all that you can to them." Several years later, after I became a physician, that same teacher asked me for my advice about a problem that his wife was having medically. And I answered it, and they were very appreciative. But I had to share with that same professor that you were discouraging people from going into medicine. And I said, "You have not gone to medical school. You have no real clue about what it takes to be a successful physician." And he had to admit, yes, that is true. But that is something I think happens all too often, that there are people who really don't have an idea about what are the characteristics that are needed to be successful in medicine and to be a good physician. And I don't see that that situation has been improved upon. And I'm just, I guess, dismayed that we're not involving those professionals who've been through this to play more of a role in helping to discuss plans and approaches on how to prepare people to go into medicine. And so I think it's not a criticism for others who are non-physicians, but I do think that it is extremely important to have people who've really gone through this path. So I'm going to break here, thoughts about my points, and we can come back to that after our break. But again, I thank our guests, who we're going to hear more from, Dr. Talanda Lipsey Brown, Dr. Delisha Randall Izzard and Mr. Anton Johnson from the Medical College of Wisconsin.
You are listening to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee with your host, Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister Dee Combs. Sankofa Council Radio Broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, and it airs on the Time for an Awakening radio platform. Reach out to them at SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. I repeat, SankofaCouncilMKE@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived, so just go to www.timeforanawakening, access the search portal, and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
Well, thank you again for being with us today. We are calling for all future Black physicians. And we are privileged to have with us today Dr. Delicia Randall Izzard, a family medicine physician, who co-wrote a program called Pipeline to Practice to help to prepare for more Black physicians being trained. We are here also with Dr. Talanda Lipsey Brown, who is one of those educators who will play and is playing a role in preparing for our future physicians. And from the Medical College of Wisconsin, Mr. Anton Johnson III, who is part of the admissions and recruiter for the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we're here discussing what it takes, what efforts are being made to prepare our young people for joining the ranks of physicians. And I'm just so delighted to have everyone here. We raised a point just before the top of the hour about the lack of Black faculty. And few people really think about someone needing to train. Some training is generic, but I do think there's some things that we've learned that serve to prepare Black students for being physicians. And
well, you know, Dr. James, that problem goes all the way back to the public schools as well, lack of faculty representation. There was a lawsuit in 1976, the Amos case, and where the school board admitted, and they had a settlement decree, and they had an affirmative action plan as a result. And then 2 years later, there was another suit, the Armstrong case, which said that there was a lack of, it was a very small representation for Black faculty in front of the classroom. And at that time, it was, I think, 16% was the targeted percentage that the court said that we had to achieve. We haven't achieved 16% yet, and that was back in 1978. So it's not just in medical, it's all across the board where we don't have ample representation for people in front of the classroom.
I'm so happy that you shared that data with us. And it is a subject that I have engaged many at the University of Wisconsin's Medical School, as well as the Medical College of Wisconsin, to have programs set up for the purpose of bringing more Blacks into medicine. And you create programs and you have Black physicians in the community that you don't bother to involve in this discussion. I think I can only describe it as being disrespectful. And I recognize perhaps that's not the intention, but I need to be on record to say that if you're trying to locate Black physicians, if you're trying to prepare for them, talk to some people who've been through this process. And that doesn't happen, but all too infrequently. And
we need to support that. We need to support that pipeline and what Dr. Izzard is doing and our guests are doing, because we need to have the political will and maybe even legislation. We need to have advocacy from the community to support that, to put what's missing where it's missing. And how do we do that? Yeah. I guess we need to find ways to do that now. Dr. James had a lot of support from her mother, who happened to be a school counselor. And like some of the people I went to high school with, their parents were definitely involved in education, but a lot of students don't have that parental involvement. I'm curious also to know what motivated Dr. Izzard to pursue a career in medicine and follow through on it.
It was my support system. My family, if I said I was going to do it, they believed me and had that support around me. And even when I ran into professors or teachers that weren't supportive, and for me, it was the high school that was less supportive, but my college was a little more supportive. It was a small, very tiny
small college that just pushed you. You said you're going to do it, and you did it. I think some of that is the idea that when students come in to schools, like Xavier is one of them, a very good school for getting Black positions. They have this support system that if the student says, I want to be a doctor, you are going to be a doctor. It isn't, yeah, maybe, no, you're Black, oh, I don't know. It is, yes, you will, and we'll support you. So for me, it was, okay, you said you want to do it. We're supporting you the whole way. It's just I've always liked science. I loved talking to people about what was going on with them, and that just went well together, medicine did. So for me, it really was that support system and being able to fail, but knowing that when I failed, I had a net. And a lot of our students really don't have that net because they have this lineage. For me, I mean, because I am working with a certain population, the lineage to slavery means that you are more likely that may have those ACE problems with adverse childhood experiences. Only 6% of the population owns a home. We have 60% of the wealth. I mean, what they are facing, it needs to be acknowledged, and they should understand. I have students coming to me thinking they're facing the same thing as their counterparts, white or other counterparts, and they are not. First of all, they need to know their history and what they are actually doing. It's magnificent to get to where they are. And then exactly. From there, getting that support system. And once they start to get that in, oh, I am doing really well. Oh, I am facing a lot of problems and I am overcoming them. It isn't me. It's actually the system that's out there that's doing this. And so when I've started to notice when they understand that and me as myself understood that, I was able to overcome a lot of barriers.
Now, what about the Black, historically Black university like Howard?
Yes.
Would they have that kind of supportive environment at Howard?
They're one of the highest schools that have students admitted, Black students admitted to medical school. So yes, they do.
So it's an entirely, Brother Charles, it's an entirely different experience, particularly among those students that are attending the historically Black colleges. Many of those students come to college lacking some of the skills. However, the teachers in those settings tend to be, prepared for dealing with some of the remedial needs to bring those students to the point that they will be able to compete. And when they go on to graduate school, they go on to the professional schools, they do extremely well. But they had, for many of them, had to deal with some remedial issues, which may include their speaking and writing skills. My husband attended a historically Black college. And did extremely well in medical school. But having been one of the top students in high school, there was really no support for him. Had there not been a teacher who took a lead role in helping him get a scholarship for college. There was no one in the family to have supported him and prepared him, perhaps in the way that I had that type of experience.
So that implies perhaps that mentoring needs to be developed or expanded where, you know, you don't have the culture, you don't have a lot of people around you who graduated from medical school. But I'm wondering, what about the alumni, like at Howard or some of the other historically Black colleges? I wonder how much involvement would you find from the alumni who graduated from those medical colleges? And is that something that's missing here in like at Wisconsin or some of the other larger schools, non-black schools.
Can I comment here? Brother Robinson, like you said, I have several friends who are now physicians, and the one comment, as you know, we consider all of our experiences, the one thing that they have in common is that each of them attended a historically black college for undergrad. And so I think that we're onto something here. It was the skills that maybe they came in if they were lacking skills, but it was also being in a place where people recognize their brilliance and their capabilities and nurtured them. And as you said, when they went on to the medical schools, you know, that were not historically black, they already knew who they were. They already knew what was within them. And so they had that advocacy that they may not have had they not gone to those institutions. I also like to speak to the mentorship piece.
Yeah.
So I met Dr. James when I was a senior in high school. There was some sort of class that I had to take where I had to go into the field that I was interested in. And my my teacher somehow connected me. I'm not even sure how she knew Dr. James, but I ended up going and interning at Dr. James's office. Now, you know, it was just observing her. Well, Dr. James saw something in me in which, after that whole entire experience was over, she hired me. And as an 18-year-old, I became her medical assistant. And I cannot begin to tell you the wealth of experiences that I gained from working and being mentored by Dr. James. Not only did I gain experience and understanding and knowledge about the medical practice, but I learned about the business side of medicine. Once Dr. James took me to a conference, a National Medical Association conference in Nashville, Tennessee, so I could see the outside lives of physicians. So, you know, by day I attended, you know, all of the workshops, but in the evening I was able to see, you know, doctors in their other element, and, you know,
they were not boring.
They were human beings, and they had fun. And I'm like, and they lived it up. And I wanted to live that life. And so I think that the mentorship piece is so important. And one more thing that I'd like to add, as Dr. Izzard is working to create this network, I would also throw in there the importance of introducing students to the curriculum early on, 8th grade, 9th grade. So those anatomy and physiology classes, organic chemistry, those areas where people may tend to struggle once they reach undergrad, teaching the students very early on so that once they arrive in undergrad, this is not the first time that they're seeing this material. And so those are just some of the ideas that I have.
Dr. Brown, my tennis partner, I was telling him yesterday that we're going to have this broadcast, and he's teaching in a summer program for enrichment in Racine right now. And he's teaching 7 and 8 year olds. And he says that this is the conversation that we should be having with children at that age. And because we could break it down to them so that they can see the possibility of something like a medical college in their future. What do you think about that? Is that too early, 7, 8 years old?
It's not too early. I totally agree. At this age, you know, kids are like sponges, you know, and you would be surprised. I have a 3 and a 5 year old, and it's just amazing what kids will learn, you know, when we teach them.
Well, if I could chime in there too.
Yes.
Go ahead. Just really quickly as well, you know, and the importance of getting that early, you know, even tying into like our pipeline programs for the high school level at MCW, that interest in STEM, that interest in biology, chemistry, you know, anatomy, physiology, getting that in early is going to make that timeline to become a doctor seem a lot less daunting. You know, so for when you're talking to like high school students, you know, freshmen, high school sophomores, what have you, like in fairs, like I was saying before, becoming a doctor doesn't seem like something that's a complete, you know, veer off a path. It's impossible and it's going to take forever because you have to relearn everything, you know, from scratch. So getting people early is such a big deal.
Just want to go and see if we have a listener at number 414-364. Do you have a comment or a question for us today? Okay, well, we'll come back and let me let Mr. Johnson continue his points.
Oh, I was done.
It's not too early, and I am a new grandmother, a 3-day-old grandson, and came with the grandson, our two, a brother and a sister, who are 6 and 7 years old. So I'm spending a lot of time with them, and what I am seeing is that those children are extremely bright, but they are focused in play. And unless you have people around that understand that there's play and there is work, and you'll be surprised what you can get out of them. But again, if you don't know what the skills are that are going to be needed in medicine, then it's hard for you to know really how to direct it. I think that some of us have been fortunate enough to have people who have been around us and prepared us in ways that maybe they didn't even quite understand. At 3 years old, and I tell my uncle, I want a diploma. I want him to make me a diploma. I didn't quite know what it was, but he made a diploma for me. And as I got older, and there are various questions, I want to give you an injection. Now, they didn't particularly enjoy participating in that process, but they had enough vision to know that this is something, this is a person that has said they're interested in being in medicine. And how do you support that? And again, I had some family members who would tell my grandmother, in fact, an aunt, why would she want to do something that hard? And this was an aunt that was a nurse. Why would you want her to do something so hard? And my grandmother would say, yes, that's right. And then she'd hand me $20. She was proud of me. She worked for a physician. And so that was a real opportunity that, as Talanda has mentioned, getting that type of mentoring. My grandmother worked for 3 doctors. And I went to work with her when we were out of school. And while my grandmother mopped the floor, cleaned the bathroom. But while we were there, I also got to see the books and the pictures and the instruments. And that individual ultimately wrote my letter of recommendation to medical school. So everybody doesn't have that kind of support. But I had been accustomed to hearing antihistamines and various types of medication. My grandmother would bring samples home, for a particular purpose. So I got to hear the language, which is important. And so I think there's so many aspects that go into this, but I do think that we've got to begin to start thinking in this way. Getting back to the point that was made, the data has shown that at least at this juncture, African-American patients do better when they are cared for by other Black doctors. Whether people want to acknowledge that and admit it, that is just the data, and that's what it supports. So if we want to improve our healthcare, one of those other pieces are is that we've got to have doctors that are in the background or in the forefront that are leading how this process should take place. You cannot ignore them and expect to get some different results.
I think what we're all agreeing on is mentoring is key, and experience and exposure, you know, exposing children as young as possible to these professions like medical professions. I have a grandson who's he's not 3 years old yet. He's at 2.5. He recognizes all of the alphabet, and he could sound out all of the letters of the alphabet. And I was walking with him about a month ago, and every time we'd come across a sign with a word, he would actually sound it out. So actually, he can read at 2 years old. So, you know, we can't be afraid to teach our kids as early as possible reading, you know, basic skills, and then to give them experiences and exposure to all kinds of things outside of the classroom. When I taught, we created my first year the expansion of educational experiences committee. It was a task force that we created, and it was designed to get kids outside of the classroom. And MPS actually incorporated that, made it a part of the transportation department. And when they did that, that program kind of got watered down. But the original intention was to have kids be exposed to as much as possible outside of the classroom and make the environment outside of the classroom part of the educational experience. Now, in Cuba, they're doing something that's so different than what we do in America regarding medical education. They actually have free medical colleges. I mean, is that true?
Yes.
Can anybody?
Yes.
And I just don't understand why America can't follow that lead. Why are we? Why you have to give up the American dream of buying a house and having a family if you go to medical school or law school or any other graduate program, because you'd be so encumbered by student loans.
But I think, Brother Charles, that some of this is designed for the purpose of discouraging people. And I've told many people that the cost of a medical education should never deter you from applying to medical school. Money comes from someplace to make it possible. If you're there, you are capable of entering medical school, a way is made. People come forward. Agencies come forward. So I really haven't seen a case where someone had to drop out of medical school because they weren't able to afford it. Many people are not aware of the National Health Service Corps that will pay you while you're in college to pursue a career in medicine. Now, what they require of you is for every year that they provided support that they expect that you will work in a federally qualified health center. That's a great deal in order to pay for your education, make sure you have a stipend. So when I hear this about I'm not going because it's so expensive, then it just tells me that you are not motivated enough to say, I am going to make this happen. So you haven't even tried.
So the resources are there.
There are resources that come up. And Mr. Johnson is working in that setting. He's working in a private medical school, and there are, despite challenges that every organization has, there are numerous gift givers that make it possible. I left medical school with no debt at all. Now, that's a program that has been disbanded, but I'm sure something else has been put in its place, and I don't know if Wisconsin has it and no one knows about it, but in Illinois, they had what's called the Illinois General Assembly Scholarship, and your legislator for your area was given a certain number of scholarships to give to students in their area. And I got one of those scholarships that was renewable every year and paid for all of my tuition. I had fees to pay and housing and books, but I did not have to pay to attend medical school. So,
wow.
And that was really in hopes that you'd stay in Illinois and practice there. I'm probably one of the few who attended the University of Illinois, a state-supported school, and found myself in another state, in Wisconsin. But I've still served the same group of patients that I was interested in serving. So again, I believe that a way becomes possible for people to fund their education. And I've never seen any of my colleagues who were singing the blues about how expensive medical school was. Even today, they are happy to be physicians, and they are hopeful that they are going to be able to repay those loans. And I think that they should be able to pay those loans back.
Absolutely. If I could cut in just quickly here, I appreciate everything that you just said. You know, this is, you know, what you said is something that I've almost said verbatim to many students that I've advised. You know, I've never seen somebody fall out of medical school for lack of funding. Not in my time doing it, not yet. You know, and even with external agencies, kind of like how you referenced here, you know, there is money out there. There's a lot of students I talk to that, you know, I don't think it's an issue of whether or not they've looked, but where they've looked, you know. Because there's no medical school that's going to turn down, you know, a group that's willing to, you know, willing to help you pay, that's going to give them money. And this is something that boils down to kind of speaking to an earlier point, too, tying it in, you know, about the importance of tapping in with Black doctors or advising these students. You know, I can't tell you how many students that I advise, they see me come on the Zoom or they come to my office and they see me and they go, you know, I see it in their face. Cool. I have a Black doctor that's going to take me through this stuff. Then they find out that I'm not a doctor or not even a medical student or have been one. You know, doesn't make my opinion any less valid? No. But at the same time, you know, you could tell they want that perspective. So from a lot of the things that we talked about, including the recent, you know, just hearing that you can do it from a funding perspective, I really, really, really want to partner with all of you. Like, I do plan to connect with all of you when all this is done. You know, if you'd be willing to connect some of the students that I work with, I would really appreciate it. Because this is all stuff they need to hear.
That's great. So
So it just sounds like we just need to get the word out and have people see that medical school is a possibility for them. It's not just for the rich and famous or people who were born with a silver spoon in their mouth or whatever. It's a possibility for anyone. Go ahead.
Could I break in real quick? Absolutely. I would love to connect with you, Mr. Johnson. And I agree with Dr. James as well. There is really, money should not be an issue. And there is one other aspect that they could consider is there is such a, depending on what field you want to go into, there's such a shortage of physicians now that a number of companies are willing to pay your loan payment possibly. So my husband actually was able to do that. So he has loans, but they're paying his loans as he works. Mm-hmm. So that option too. So he's not part, he does work for a federally qualified health center, but it's not part of that whole system. They just decided to pay it for him. So that is that option as well.
Well, that's great. Now, does your husband work at the center that's on MLK Drive?
Yes, he works at that one.
Oh, okay.
Not only does he work there, Charles, he is the chief executive officer of Milwaukee Health Services, which is on King Drive. Yes.
Wow.
Which is why he can't get the funding really from the National Health Services, but they pay for him this way. But it was even before he was the president. He just wrote it in his contract. So that's another thing we can tell the students is, you have some power in writing your contract out and what you want to do. So through the pipeline, we do mentor them through placement into their chosen field. So to help them with that, with those different issues that come up.
And that was my clinic.
Oh, okay.
I went there for many years. Yeah, that was my clinic.
Well, I'm very proud it's interesting you raise that question, Brother Charles, because throughout this mentoring process, I served as the chief medical officer for that same clinic, Milwaukee Health Services. And I was asked at a point there to recommend an assistant chief medical officer or medical director, and I did. And I recommended Dr. Tito Izzard as a family medicine physician from the community. I knew he was making a change in his job situation, and he ultimately became chief medical officer and then the chief executive officer. So that's a form of mentoring. It is an ongoing effort that we continue to look at what the needs are of our community. So we needed a Dr. Tito Izzard to step into that role, having been exceptionally trained to fulfill the needs of that organization. So
that is so great.
With little children, but it continues all the way through.
Yeah, and I forgot it. I completely forgot. You've been such an influence in our lives. I am so sorry I forgot about it. It's been, what, 15 years? It's been a long time, and I forgot, but thank you for that. I want to tell you thank you again. Your vision for him and was just, I can't count the worth of it.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Izzard, I have a question. Your pipeline proposal, that program sounds so promising. Are you able to share that with MPS and get the backing from some of the schools? I would suspect it would be great to start at least at the middle school level and on up to the high school level. Are you getting any support from MPS?
What I am trying to do right now is, unfortunately, we don't have enough, well, because of the whole problem of not having enough physicians, we are trying to, I mean, there are a possibility of non-Black physicians actually being involved in this, but I'm trying to keep the mentors, if we can, Black at this time. So there's a limited amount that we have. So I'm only going to high school right now. So we're not going all the way back just yet. And then the other problem is I am trying to work with the North Division. I'm working with AHEC, who's also working within the system too, that Academy of Health system for North Division, and trying to work with them and setting a program up and helping them get mentors from Madison and from, if at all possible, from MCW, but that's in a process right now. And I'm also working with SBC, who also is on the board of North Division, who's trying to get the program more integrated into North Division as well. So it's all in a working process, but it's mostly geared towards North Division right now.
Got it. Well, thank you.
Charles, I will mention to you, and I don't know if you're aware of this, Milwaukee has a school called the Milwaukee Academy of Sciences, and its founder was a former dean of the Medical College of Wisconsin, whose vision it was that such a school would serve as a way of increasing the number of Black physicians. And the Cream City Medical Society met recently, it's been about a year ago, with the CEO of the school. And that school's been in existence at least for 10 years, if not more. And my question to them is, how many of your students have become physicians, and how many of them are physicians or were trained at the Medical College of Wisconsin? The answer that I got, and I hope that I misunderstood, was zero.
Mm.
So you have a school that you have prepared that has received some support from our local medical school, the Medical College of Wisconsin, and I'd have to ask, what's going on? That there've got to be some students, some young people who have a vision to be a doctor, and they're going to be receive direction on helping to make this happen. And he said that his challenge has been finding kids who are just motivated to come to school. And I said, this is the wrong school for them. This is a school for people who know I want to be a doctor. And what do I need to know to make that happen? And I happened to go to a school where there were several of my members of that high school who became doctors and continue to do so. So I think that when you've got a school with that kind of preparation, your parents should know about it and say, this is where I want you to go to school, where you're going to get a chance to go to a cadaver lab or to sit in a classroom where people are learning the skills of a physician. We have that structure here in place, but I again feel that we do not have actually the faculty who either are receiving the support that they need or the background information about what to do to prepare their students for the challenges that will accompany becoming a physician.
Wow, you just mentioned something that our guest would, I'm certain, would be interested in looking into, to finding out what's missing in those situations where you have a school dedicated and created for that purpose, and but then it seems like there's something missing, and or somebody's dropping the ball, or maybe you need more parental involvement. I don't know what the solution is, but it would be, I think, a good project to look into. Mr. Johnson, what do you see in that?
You know, that was difficult to hear and surprising. You know, I'm aware of our relationship with the Milwaukee Academy of Science. Many of our doctors, including some doctors in leadership here at MCW, you know, have involvement with MAS. I know we have our STRIVE program, kind of focused on trauma and resilience in youth, is there for the younger grades. Also, our DRIVE program, which is kind of an intro to community health kind of thing, working with the high school sophomores to senior levels over a two-trimester period to help them network with the MCW community and, you know, learn about careers of interest and work on a – we actually have them work on a small community health-related problem. But maybe, you know, it's sounding like maybe our involvement or our programming, from our perspective, is a little more broad, and you know, maybe we need something more laser focused. Like, all right, if you're here because you want to be a doctor, this is what we need to do to make this happen. So you know, this is definitely something that you know, I'm interested in assisting with from an admission standpoint too. I admit that I haven't had that much involvement with the Milwaukee Academy of Science from an MCW perspective myself, except for talking to them a couple of times. But you know, if there's another program or another initiative, you know, that even me or, you know, some of us on this call here could partner with and you know, focus that interest, let's do it.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that point. I think that we need to be intentional in going to our institutions and saying, taking the data, disaggregating the data, right down to the local level. How many of the students within this medical college are products of the Milwaukee public school system? And if the answer is zero, I should say, how many Black students are products of the Milwaukee public school system? And if the answer is zero, all, you know, one, two, three, whatever, there's a problem. There's a broken link there. And we can tell our students all day, you know, we can show them this is the road to get to medical school, but if we're not also working on the other end and dismantling those institutional practices which keep them out, such as MCAT, the MCAT, and, you know, other things that are used in admission, grade point averages, and we need to do work on both ends in preparing our students, but also in dismantling some of those institutional policies and practices that have kept that door closed.
I definitely agree with that, especially from a stats perspective too. You know, these things are continuing to creep in. MCAT and GPA and, you know, standardized testing is going up constantly. More people are applying to medical school. Almost the majority of medical schools that I know of had record numbers of applicants. So this, this playing field in these, you know, schools with pre-screens and cutoffs, you know, the wall is going to get higher that way. And that's a conversation that needs to be had, because that ties into, again, the first thing that I said on this call. You know, we say underrepresented groups. I think that's a euphemism. I think we need to call them the historically excluded. And, you know, these things are a mechanism of that.
Well, Mr. Johnson, as a challenge for you, and I don't think it should be that difficult, as a recruiter with the Medical College of Wisconsin, you have here amongst you a person, Dr. Tulipsy Brown, who I've said is a product of the Milwaukee Public Schools, Marquette University, and has a PhD. And she's still young enough to be a physician. Mm-hmm. Now, whether she is interested at this time, she was interested at one point, and she, in my mind, has demonstrated her ability to be a scholar and to pursue and be resilient. She'd be a person that I would think would be a easy bet from the standpoint of her success. And I would be recruiting Dr. Talonda Lipsy to attend the Medical College of Wisconsin. That is certainly an example of some, I'm not speaking for Dr. Talonda Lipsy, and she has her life and her family, but what I'm saying, you don't have to go back and get a five-year-old. Here's somebody who already has been in the pipeline, and the question merely needs to be, what can we do to convince her, and what can we do to make her successful? And if being mentored while she's there, I'll be the first in line, because I know she'll be successful. Dr. Randall Izzard will have herself, her husband, others from the Cream City Medical Society who would mentor somebody who's already a PhD. Come on now. How can you miss that opportunity? So I will make sure that the two of you have contact information. But this is an example, dear, in terms of how this process must work. And we need to be able to say, calling all future physicians. People have children, they have students who show an interest, who've expressed an interest, and they need some direction. And not just some money is good. We like that too. But you in those positions have to be willing to step out and say, this is a good bet. This is somebody who definitely will do well in our school. And this is somebody we want to be a part of the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Well put. Absolutely. And again, going back to what I said a couple of times, you know, I definitely want to keep in touch with, you know, this panel for various reasons, but including, you know, we can definitely talk from a perspective of somebody, you know, who has a scholarly background and has this interest or had it in the past. You know, let's speak to it.
Yes, and, you know, we need to have all hands on deck as well, because parents need to be involved in their children's education. And those of us who are stakeholders who don't even, you know, have children in schools anymore, we need to go out and vote for the right kind of people to lead education in Milwaukee. The voter turnout for school board elections, I believe, is under 10%. So we need across the board advocacy and support from the home all the way up to the state capitol.
Well, we have to go to our sponsor, EDOC Advice. At EDOC Advice, we provide specific medical answers to those seeking a better understanding about medical conditions and health. We offer our faculty of EDOCs, who are licensed physicians and health professionals, who make themselves available to those globally seeking a better understanding of health issues and medical practice. We also want to know that sponsors are welcomed. Do you have a service you want others to know about? Have you written a book we need to read? Consider becoming a sponsor. Email the Black Reality Think Tank at sankofa_think@outlook.com. Contributions to support our broadcasting efforts can be made to Cash App, $Nirvana, INSTI, and PayPal, sankofa_think@outlook.com. If you have a comment, you have a question for the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, our email address is sankofacouncilmke@gmail.com. We are most delighted to have had in our midst today Dr. Delisha Randall Izzard, family medicine physician, who is a co-writer of The Pipeline to Practice. We have Ms. Dr. Talanda Lipsey Brown, who is a product of the Milwaukee Public Schools, Marquette University, and is an educator in sciences. And we have Mr. Anton Johnson, who is here, recruiter for the Medical College of Wisconsin. We are most pleased to have all here with us today. And we thank you for joining us today. I thank also the Sankofa Council for its support of this program and for sharing their vision for unity following Afrocentric principles and helping us to learn and use those principles in our lives. We look forward to bringing to you more programming that we hope you will enjoy. Visit our sponsor, www.edocadvice.com. Good night. Stay safe. Thank you, Brother Charles Robinson, who came in to help us today. We miss our other hosts, Sister Dee Dee Conley, Brother Kwasi Kraft.
Dr. James?
Yes, sir.
I just got one.
I want the legal studies around
myself. In a little tent.
I'm good. Never again.
Oh, and just like the river I've been running. Ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
All right then. Thank you.
Oh, yes, it will. It's been too. Up there beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. Help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought I could last for long.
alone.